Concordia Theological Seminary presents The Heart of the Apocalypse, A Teaching for All Times, a paper presented on January 18, 2000 by Dr. James C. Vanderkam at the 15th Annual Symposium on Exegetical Theology held at Concordia Theological Seminary.
And the exegetical symposium has always had as its feature the selection of an internationally known scholar. And we are most privileged this year to have one who is an expert in precisely the topic that we are studying, Jewish apocalyptic and Christian apocalyptic. He is the John A. O'Brien Professor of Theology at that great Lutheran university in South Bend, Indiana. He has his PhD from Harvard University in Near Eastern Languages and Civilization. He has published about a dozen books, edited many others, with particular focus on the Book of Jubilees, Enoch and the Growth of the Apocalyptic Tradition, and a variety of Dead Sea Scrolls publications. In fact, he's one of the consulting editors for the DJD series. Numerous articles and book reviews have been written by him as well. So please welcome with me Dr. James C. Vanderkam, who will deliver our keynote.
Thank you very much. As President Winthy said, I come from that great Lutheran school in South Bend, Indiana. When I first arrived at Notre Dame in 1991, I taught a class that all Notre Dame undergraduates are required to take, which is called Foundations of Theology. And it's a course that's supposed to give you a quick introduction to the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the first couple centuries of church history. So we really move in that class. And as we were in the early church segment of the class, we were going to talk about some of the early struggles with heresy. So I asked the students who were freshmen and sophomores if they knew what a heretic was. And somebody raised his hand and explained what the term meant. And I asked, could you give me an example of a heretic? And he said, Martin Luther. At least he didn't say John Calvin, but I was surprised, and my teaching assistant at the time was a Lutheran pastor who was also surprised, and I had to come up with a quick answer for that one. I think I said something about, well, one person's heretic is another person's hero, or something like that. I want to talk about the subject, The Heart of the Apocalypses, A Teaching for All Times, and in that way continue the theme that Dr. Gieschen began with this morning. All of us have recently been through what seemed to have the potential for being an apocalyptic moment. The approach of the year 2000 had many people, especially Christians, excited about what might happen. We all know what did happen. Nothing. But I suspect that many of us felt some apprehension as the time drew near, and we were relieved that we could comfortably laugh again at the more eschatologically minded who've been left with a large reserve food and water supplies. And we hope they'll donate them to good causes. People who've tried to predict or calculate when the end, whatever that is taken to mean, will come, have had a really poor track record. That does not mean, of course, that they do not keep trying. We seem to have survived the Y2K scare, but there's no reason to think that the urge to identify the end of time as we know it, when it will disappear. Only a few years ago, we read about the Heaven's Gate movement, a group that followed the teachings of a cult leader named Marshall Applewhite. They awaited the Hale-Bopp comet in San Diego, California, good place to wait for comets, but perished in a group suicide in March 1997. The phenomena of predicting the end and of groups of people following some supposedly chosen leader have gone hand in hand, in some cases ancient and modern. We know from reports from the first century historian Josephus that several eschatologically minded characters appeared in his time and tried to force the divine miracle to bring on a new age. In a general statement in his book, The Jewish War, when writing about the 50s of the first century, he refers to, quote, deceivers and imposters under the pretense of divine inspiration, fostering revolutionary changes. They persuaded the multitude to act like madmen and led them out into the desert under the belief that God would give them tokens of deliverance. There was the prophet Thutis, he says, who persuaded his followers to take their belongings and go to the Jordan River, which was to part at his command, as it had done for Joshua many centuries before. Roman troops intervened and cut off his head. Another such individual Josephus calls the Egyptian, who led his followers from the desert to the Mount of Olives and waited for something to happen. This is the Egyptian with whom Paul is confused in Acts 21, when a tribune says to him, "Then you are not the Egyptian who recently stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 assassins out into the wilderness." And Josephus reports a few years later that the governor Festus sent a force of cavalry and infantry against the dupes of a certain impostor who had promised them salvation and rest from troubles if they chose to follow him into the wilderness. The force which the governor dispatched destroyed both the deceiver themselves and those who had followed him, he says. Now, such cases we can easily dismiss. Those leaders, we can say, were unbalanced people whose folly and misreadings of the times and of divine plans cost them and their followers dearly. But Christians and Jews cannot dismiss apocalyptic ideas outright because we are deeply involved with them. The Bible contains full-blown apocalypses, and elsewhere also speaks of the last times. The Old Testament gives us the book of Daniel, the second part of which is filled with four apocalypses. The New Testament concludes with the revelation of John, the book that gave us the name Apocalypse. And besides these two works, there are many other passages in the scriptures that can be characterized as apocalyptic. We should be clear about what we mean by apocalypse and what appear to have been the purposes that such works served then and now. In recent decades, scholars have become accustomed to differentiate between three words: the word apocalypse, the phrase apocalyptic eschatology, and the noun apocalypticism. A commonly used definition of the word apocalypse these days is that it is a type of revelatory literature with a narrative framework in which a revelation is mediated by an otherworldly being to a human recipient, disclosing a transcendent reality which is both temporal insofar as it envisages eschatological salvation and spatial insofar as it involves another supernatural world. It's the definition given by John Collins. Apocalypses, on this definition, do not so much stand in contrast to prophecies in a formal sense as they do in regularly having a supernatural revealer who stands between the seer and God, and it's usually an angel. And they also differentiate themselves from prophecies by their more distant focus, whether on final salvation or on an otherwise invisible world. Now, these apocalypses of that sort frequently express an apocalyptic eschatology in which the seer, who despairs of reforming the present world, thinks of God's saving acts not as the fulfillment of promises within political structures and historical events, as was the case with the prophecies, but as deliverance out of the present order into a new transformed order. The abstract noun apocalypticism is now used to designate ways of acting and thinking through which a group understands and justifies itself as alienated from a dominant culture whose validity it denies. People who embrace such a worldview look forward to a new world that is still invisible to normal sight. Only the specially chosen and inspired seers to whom revelation is given can pierce that barrier. As the Bible itself shows, there are different kinds of apocalypses. Some give historical surveys, often presented as if they were predictions, and others furnish travelogues, we could call them, about adventures in otherwise inaccessible places like heaven. Daniel's apocalyptic chapters belong to the historical category, while the book of Revelation focuses more on what happens in heaven, the realm of God and his court. In recent times, there has been debate among scholars about what are the distinctive or essential contents of apocalypses. In the past, there had been a strong tendency to focus on the predictions that we find in the apocalypses, with less attention being paid to the fact that they are often, like the New Testament book of Revelation, more concerned with describing heavenly and other unusual locales. The definition of apocalypse that I quoted just a moment ago attempts to deal with both types of apocalypses, the historical and the travelogue type. It points out that apocalypses deal with things that are transcendent in two ways, in time, that is, they deal with the future, or in spatial terms, they deal with the world beyond. Now, we know that apocalypses did this sort of thing, but why did their writers choose to clothe their messages in such unusual literary form? We do not know very much about the reasons why these people wrote as they did, because they often don't explain their intentions to us. Presumably, or so they want us to believe, their revelatory experiences drove them to write as they did. But if we ask more mundane questions about their causes and goals, how was their life going then? Were they fighting with their wives and children, or what was going on? We are reduced to inferring what these causes may have been from what the authors wrote. And of course, that's not a fail-proof approach. Nevertheless, the evidence does allow some general conclusions. John Collins, who gave us the definition of apocalypse that I quoted, also gives us a statement about purpose. He says, apocalypses are intended to interpret present earthly circumstances in the light of the supernatural world and of the future. So to help us interpret the present in light of the future and the supernatural world, and also to influence understanding and behavior of the audience by divine authority. In interpreting the present and influencing understanding and behavior, these two terms do in fact appear to be important goals of those who write apocalypses. But such academic sounding phrases may not capture the passion with which some of the apocalypses are filled. It would be a real bonus in reading the apocalypses to know the contexts in which the seers worked. However, as one might expect, we have few data about such things, about their social, political, economic, and even religious circumstances. As a result, it's hard to say much about the subject. But it is at least clear that some apocalyptic texts were written in times of persecution and despair, or rather, times that their authors understood to be ones of persecution and despair. Daniel's visions were written at a time when the practice of Judaism had been outlawed and the traditional temple service had been replaced by a foreign cult. John in the New Testament tells us that he received his revelations under trying circumstances, as he explains in 1:9, I, John, your brother, who share with you in Jesus the persecution and the kingdom and the patient endurance, was on the island called Patmos because of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. As his autobiographical statement indicates, not only John himself, who was banished to an island prison, but also his audiences, the seven churches of Asia Minor, were enduring trying, dangerous times, a point documented in several of the letters in chapters 2 and 3. Texts that meet the definition of apocalypse that I quoted start to appear after Alexander the Great's famous campaigns through the Near East in the 330s and the 320s BC. His arrival introduced a new era of foreign domination, a time of real change in the lives of people. Apocalyptic works continued to be written in different places during the Hellenistic and Roman empires. In those periods, native rule of the various Near Eastern states, wherever it could still be found after the Persian Empire had ruled the region, that native rule came to an end, with little hope that under normal circumstances it would be restored. In this sense, at least some of the apocalypses may be construed as a form of protest literature that, in veiled and often cryptic language, maybe for safety's sake, harshly criticizes the foreign power, looks eagerly for divine judgment upon it, and encourages the faithful that soon there would be a supernatural change. In a broader sense, all apocalypses are protest literature, in that they damn the present and anticipate a much brighter future. We have examples of apocalypses from various cultures, such as Egypt. They do not come only from Jewish or Christian writers. Now, naturally, in the Jewish tradition, the Hebrew Bible served as the primary source for later apocalyptic writing and thinking. The prophetic tradition undoubtedly contributed forms and themes, but it is also evident that as they interpreted enigmatic visions or other disclosures, the apocalyptists imitated the arts of diviners, experts who claimed the ability to decode cryptic messages, such as dreams and configurations of stars or planets. Although the writers of the apocalypses exploited scriptural material and imitated some biblical forms, no Jewish writer composed an apocalypse in Collins' sense of the term until the 3rd century BC. After considering the definitions of terms, we should look at some examples of apocalypses in order to see how the writers worked and whether there is a valuable, enduring message conveyed through these unusual means. Recalling the passage cited from Josephus a little while ago, it would be interesting to know more about these revolutionary first century leaders whose campaigns came to violent ends. How had they come to the conclusion that the time was right for their radical acts and for God to intervene once more decisively in Israel's history? Did these people, like Thutis, study the prophecies? And like so many others through the ages, did they see their own times mirrored in the biblical prophetic books? Or were they simply responding to the changed political and social conditions of the first century, when Roman misgovernment and Jewish unrest were growing, when the ancient promises of God seemed so distant and far from being fulfilled, and all may have seemed hopeless? We don't know, but whatever caused them to act as they did, they turned out to be wrong and suffered the consequences, just as their successors have. Though we learn little from Josephus about these misguided characters, there does seem to be something apocalyptic about their actions and hopes. And it is easy for us to dismiss them and others like them through the centuries, who, whether out of misjudging their own importance or misreading the text and the times, have deluded a band of followers, often with tragic results. But to dismiss them, to put them into the same class as those who became obsessed with all that the Y2K abbreviation came to symbolize, puts us in danger of missing something very important, of giving up a part of our religious heritage, the enduring message of the apocalypses. If we concede the apocalyptic visions and teachings of those scriptural works to people with overly heated imaginations and dubious agendas, to people we consider nuts, we run the risk of silencing a powerful scriptural voice. Perhaps a look at one of the biblical apocalypses, the book of Daniel, in its ancient context will help us see what was generic or formal about such writing and what is timeless, of unchanging significance. There have been calculators of times for centuries, these crunchers of numbers, and the works of some of them are in the Bible. That aspect of their message turned out to be wrong. But even through such media, they proclaim a message for today and for all times. In the book of Daniel, we find an enthusiasm for symbolic numbers and chronology, for calculations regarding when a decisive event was to occur. Real problems developed in connection with those numbers, but the book nevertheless made it into the canon of Scripture, both for Jews and for Christians. It may come as something of a surprise that Jewish authorities incorporated Daniel into the Scriptures because of the terrible experiences of the first and second revolts against Rome, 66 to 70 and 132 to 135. Apocalyptically minded people played important roles in those revolts. Those revolts led to untold numbers of deaths and vast suffering for the survivors. It's often said that those experiences led rabbinic authorities to set aside the rich apocalyptic literature of the Jewish past and to focus their energies in other directions. However that may be, the book of Daniel is present in the Jewish Bible, although it takes its place among the writings, not among the prophets. The power of its message wanted a place there. As you know, the book of Daniel is usually dated by critical scholars to approximately 165 BC, although it is recognized that the stories in the first half of the book may be older. If the date of 165 is correct, Daniel was written and published during the Maccabean Revolt that was at least in part inspired by the Seleucid king Antiochus IV's decree prohibiting the fundamental acts of the Jewish religion. The temple had been profaned and reconstituted as a sanctuary for a pagan god, and none of the traditional religious practices, such as circumcision and the festivals, was permitted. It was a time of unprecedented crisis, something that is apparent in the passion of the book. In the Jewish and Protestant form of Daniel, it's arranged in two parts. The first six chapters give the familiar stories about Daniel and his three friends, upper-class exiles from Judah, who were serving in the courts of the Neo-Babylonian kings Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, and in that of the still unidentified Darius the Mede. Daniel distinguishes himself by interpreting dreams, deciphering a mysterious wall inscription, and all four of the friends are remarkable for their faithful behavior in difficult circumstances. The second part of the book, chapters 7 through 12, changes the roles by having Daniel, the dream interpreter of the first part, become the recipient of four apocalyptic visions, which require explanation from his angelic associates. Those visions are chock full of images and symbols that are strange, shocking, and even frightening. They leave Daniel stunned and bewildered until they are explained. Sometimes he's still stunned and bewildered even after they're explained. As he says at the end of chapter 7, "As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly terrified me, and my face turned pale, but I kept the matter in my mind." And two chapters later, he says, "So I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Then I rose and went about the king's business, but I was dismayed by the vision and did not understand it." This is even after it was explained to him. Daniel 9 is an intriguing passage for anyone interested in biblical apocalypses and their penchant for numbers and chronology. I realize there may be even more people who are not interested in biblical apocalypses, their penchant for numbers and chronology. But Daniel 9 is still a good chapter, even if you don't like those things, because it contains a moving powerful prayer of confession that produces immediate results as Daniel pleads with the Lord to redress the devastated condition of Jerusalem and the temple. The chapter begins by placing it in its time. It says it was the first year of Darius, son of Ahasuerus, by birth a Mede. And as you probably know, people have been trying to find such a Darius the Mede ever since, without success. But in his first year, Daniel says, quote, "I perceived in the books the number of years that according to the word of the Lord to the prophet Jeremiah must be fulfilled for the devastation of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. It is common practice for commentators to point out that Daniel is here referring to Jeremiah's prophecy. After all, he mentions him here. And Jeremiah's prophecy of 70 years is found in Jeremiah 25, 12, and 29, 10. Jeremiah prophesies that Jerusalem would lie desolate for 70 years, for Babylon's 70 years. But the verse just quoted from Daniel 9 suggests that matters are not quite so straightforward as that Daniel was reading Jeremiah, although he probably was doing that too. It says Daniel was reading in the books, plural, not in just one of them. It seems that the writer has in mind not only Jeremiah's familiar prophecy, but also the material found at the very end of 2 Chronicles. There, the compiler, after recording the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple by the Babylonians, writes that all this happened to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had made up for its Sabbaths. All the days that it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. In the first year of King Cyrus of Persia, in fulfillment of the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord stirred up the spirit of King Cyrus of Persia. That's from 2 Chronicles 36, 21 to 22. The Chronicles passage, which Daniel seems to be pondering along with the prophecies of Jeremiah, casts the prophet's 70 years oracle in a different light by relating it to the theme of Sabbaths of years, or sabbatical years. Such language sends one from one neglected book of the Bible, namely Chronicles, to another, namely Leviticus, where the meaning of sabbatical years is set forth. That theme was to be an important one, not only for Daniel, but for other writers in the Jewish apocalyptic tradition, who saw history divided into meaningful units of seven, which they called weeks of years. Chronicles explains that the number 70 in Jeremiah's prophecies is not accidental, but conveys a purposeful message. It is conditioned by the need of the land to experience Sabbath relief, to lie fallow, because that wise agricultural practice had been neglected. The 70 years are seen, then, as involving 10 of these sabbatical or seven-year units. According to Leviticus 25, when Israel entered the land that the Lord was giving to them, and it's stressed here that the Lord is the owner of the land and he's letting his people use it, the law given there is that 6 years you shall sow your field and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in their yield. But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of complete rest for the land, a Sabbath of the Lord. You shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard. You shall not reap the aftergrowth of your harvest or gather the grapes of your unpruned vine. It shall be a year of complete rest for the land. Leviticus 25, 3 to 5. That sabbatical institution, much loved by scholars, which we know in later periods was observed by Jews, we know this from 1 Maccabees, had not, so says Chronicles, been practiced before the destruction of Jerusalem. In order to make up for the neglect, 10 of these sabbatical units had to pass before the people would return to their land. Sabbatical years are the conclusion of a period, and like the weekly Sabbath, they are to be times of complete rest from normal labor. So much is clear from Leviticus 25. But the chapter goes on to explain that the legislation regarding the Jubilee must also be kept, that is, the year that came after seven of these sabbatical units, or 49 years. It too was to become a crucial concept in some texts. Once the legislator has explained the laws of the Jubilee year at considerable length, he turns in chapter 26, Leviticus 26, to the covenantal significance of obeying the Lord's commands. If Israel follows his teachings, the rains will fall, the land will be productive, and there will be security and peace. The Lord will be their God, and they will be his people. If they disobey, the opposite will happen. As a matter of fact, Daniel 9 points us to this chapter in Leviticus, to Leviticus chapter 26. In Daniel 9, verse 11, he includes in his prayer these words: "All Israel has transgressed your law and turned aside, refusing to obey your voice. So the curse and the oath written in the law of Moses, the servant of God, have been poured out upon us because we have sinned against you." He does this twice in the book. Leviticus 26, after mentioning the sorts of evils that would befall the people if they disobeyed, adds, "And if in spite of this you will not obey me, I will continue to punish you sevenfold for your sins." Verse 18. That word sevenfold punishment for one's sins, should grab our attention because it has significance for understanding Daniel 9. The punishment for persistent disobedience would be multiplied seven times. The point must be important for the writer of Leviticus 26 because he repeats it three more times. Later, after predicting that the land and cities would be devastated and the people scattered to the nations, the writer of Leviticus adds, "Then the land shall enjoy its Sabbath years, as long as it lies desolate. While you are in the land of your enemies, then the land shall rest and enjoy its Sabbath years. As long as it lies desolate, it shall have the rest it did not have on your Sabbaths when you were living on it." All of this, I think, was in the writer's mind as he has Daniel reading from the books about Jeremiah's 70-year prophecy. Or so it seems from the response given to his prayer by God through the angel Gabriel. Daniel's prayer had been heard, and using the vague language so common in apocalyptic texts, the angel comes to him and says that at the beginning of your supplications, a word went out, and I have come to declare it. That is, God had sent Gabriel with an answer. His answer is not so much a direct one as an explanation of the meaning of the 70 years. Only a proper understanding of the number would permit one to understand when the desolation of the land and city would end. Quote, 70 weeks are decreed. 70 weeks, says Gabriel in verse 24. Jeremiah's 70 years had become 70 weeks of years, in accord with the teaching of Leviticus that the punishment for persistent evil would be sevenfold. It was not that Jeremiah was off by a couple of centuries, or just plain wrong. For our author, Jeremiah was right. But the ongoing evil of the nation, for hundreds of years by the time the book of Daniel was written, that ongoing evil dictated that God extend the punishment seven times 70 years. The assumption behind the text is that Jeremiah's prophecy could not have been mistaken or unfulfilled. There could be no such thing as failed prophecy from one called and inspired by God. The issue was to understand it properly, and that required deeper knowledge of the scriptures that the angel brought to the confused and disconsolate Daniel. Gabriel does not rest content with simply stating that 70 years had become 70 weeks of years. He also spelled out the division of those 70 weeks in a way that invites the reader to figure them out, but that still leaves questions about how to relate them to what we know about post-exilic history. A whole raft of textual problems here doesn't help. We do not have to explore the diverse ways in which people have interpreted the numbers. It is more important for our purposes to observe the patterns. The first unit mentioned is 7 weeks, that is 49 years, or a jubilee period. It stretches from the time when the command to rebuild the city went out until an anointed prince would arise, says Gabriel. Perhaps the governor Zerubbabel or the high priest Joshua in the immediate post-exilic period is meant here. There follows 62 weeks, says Gabriel, when the city is in existence until another anointed one is cut off. He is usually identified with the deposed and executed high priest Onias III, about whom we read in 2 Maccabees. He lost the high priesthood in 175 BC, and his death occurred 3 years later. That point also marks, says the angel, the arrival of a prince who destroys the city and sanctuary. This prince is very likely the notorious Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, the Seleucid king who banned Judaism and defiled the temple in 167 BC. The interesting item for us, though, is the temporal framework into which the angel puts all of this, into which he places King Antiochus. He says, "He shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week." We had already had 69 weeks. Now we're into the last one, the 70th. "And for half of the week he shall make sacrifice and offering cease, and in their place shall be an abomination that desolates until the decreed end is poured out on the desolator." The period in question is almost certainly the 3-year period when the temple was in pagan hands, from about 167 to 164 BC. And this span, the angel fits into a sabbatical chronology. It is a half week, 3.5 years for him. After that will come the punishment of the one who had served as an instrument of God's punishment, and at last, presumably, Jeremiah's prophecy of restoration would be fulfilled. That number, 3.5, is an important one in Daniel's visions. We meet it elsewhere outside this chapter, although it is often expressed in other terms. However it is expressed in the book, it needs to be understood against the backdrop of Daniel's sabbatical theology. The first of these examples where it occurs is in chapter 7, where we read about 4 hideous beasts arising from the sea, itself a terrifying place. The fourth of these beasts is even worse than the others. It has iron teeth and 10 horns, followed by a smaller 11th horn, which had eyes and a mouth speaking arrogant words. After the 4 beasts are described, the judgment is held before one who is called Ancient of Days. The beasts are removed from power or killed, and one like a son of man receives eternal dominion, glory, and kingship, says Daniel. The angel later explains in chapter 7 that the 4 beasts are 4 kings who will arise out of the earth. But he says the holy ones of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever. While explaining that arrogant little horn on the 4th beast, the interpreting angel says, "He shall speak words against the Most High, shall wear out the holy ones of the Most High, and shall attempt to change the sacred seasons and the law, and they shall be given into his power for a time, times, and half a time." The judgment follows. The time, times, and half a time are understood by commentators to mean 3.5 times, that is, time, 2 times, and half a time. And there's evidence supporting this conclusion. They certainly do remind one of the half week of years, or 3.5 years in Daniel 9, and the charges made against the blasphemous little horn, that he speaks words against the Most High, wears out the holy ones, and tries to change times and law, all these point to what Antiochus did in prohibiting Judaism. So that it seems as though the 3.5 times of chapter 7 are the same as the 3.5 weeks of Daniel 9. We find something very similar in Daniel 8, the second of his visions. There he sees a ram with two horns, who is suddenly confronted by a one-horned goat from the west. Horns are a big thing in Daniel's visions. This one smashed the ram and broke its horns, but when it was at the zenith of its power, the horn of the goat was broken, with four horns not as large growing in its place, he says, toward the four winds of heaven. Apparently, Alexander the Great and the successor kingdoms. Another horn grew up out of one of them and became great. It attacked the host of heaven, took the regular burnt offering away, and overthrew the sanctuary. Again, we're in the time of Antiochus IV. A holy one asked how long this would last, and the reply he gives reminds us of chapter 7. For how long is this vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and host to be trampled? And he answered him, for 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state. The angel Gabriel provides the commentary on the vision, explaining that it had to do with the time of the end in verse 17, that the ram with two horns stood for the kings of Media and Persia, and the male goat symbolized the king of Greece, and the great horn between its eyes is the first king, that is Alexander. As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others arose, he says that four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. Results in deaths among the wise who resist him. A paragraph about the religious practices of this king and his divine pretensions precedes 11:40-45, where we learn about his demise. The king is transparently Antiochus IV once more. According to chapter 12, a time of anguish follows, but those found written in the book of life will be delivered. With many who sleep in the dust, it says, rising either to everlasting life or to everlasting contempt. A rare Old Testament reference to resurrection. Someone asks how long it will be until the end of these wonders, and the answer received is a time, times, and half a time. A few verses later, Daniel is told, from the time that the regular burnt offering is taken away, and the abomination that desolates is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Happy are those who persevere and attain the 1,335 days. Chapter 12, verses 11 through 12. In other words, hear the expression a time, times, and half a time, and a specific number of days are paired. The period of temple profanation is given now as 1,290 days, which is 3 years plus 195, and 1,335 days, or 3 years plus 240 days. And all these numbers are around 3.5 years. That last number being the number that the faithful are called upon to endure. We may see before our very eyes an example of apocalyptic juggling with numbers. The number of days increases, apparently, as events develop. More important than the seemingly malleable numbers is the promise that redemption would arrive at the end of the half week of years, the sanctuary would be restored, the just would be raised to eternal life, and the wicked would be raised to suffer everlasting contempt. So Daniel, using the language of Jeremiah, Chronicles, and Leviticus, expressed his unbending confidence that God would act as he had promised, and that he would do so when he had indicated, somewhat cryptically to be sure, through the prophet Jeremiah. The book of Daniel is an apocalypse that calls on the faithful to persevere,
because the one who controls history and all kingdoms has promised to act. It was not a time to give up or to assume that the promises had failed. It was a moment in which to have hope. The writer did not call on the faithful to take up arms or torch Antiochus' palace. Rather, he urged them through his often bizarre language and symbols to endure, because despite appearances, God was there and would right all wrong. At the end, the rest from oppression that had been promised would arrive, and God's people would enjoy an ultimate Sabbath. Was the author of Daniel right? It depends on what is to be understood as the end for which he looked. Something decisive did happen the next year when Judas Maccabeus and his men recaptured the temple, purified it, and reinstituted the traditional cult. But that end was not as definitive as the language of the book suggests, and so Daniel's predictions, like those of Jeremiah, became a subject of interpretation, as we can see, for example, in the book of Revelation. There, the 3.5 years of Daniel return, although again different numbers are used, one of which is 42 months, exactly 3.5 years. In appealing to the sabbatical language that he does, the author of Daniel may well have been imitating the practice of some contemporary writers. One of these was the author of a short text that belongs in the Enoch tradition. It's an apocalypse called the Apocalypse of Weeks. It's in the first book of Enoch, chapters 93 and 91, oddly enough in that order. They've been switched around. But that short apocalypse describes, it's given to Enoch before the flood, the text tells us. It was revealed to him by angels. And that short apocalypse tells us all about history. And it divides history into 10 weeks, the writer calls it. So the history lasts for 10 weeks. 70 years, it sounds like, or 70 days. And anyone who knows the Bible well can read the description of the different weeks in those chapters in 1st Enoch and will recognize them. The writer points out one or two important ideas or persons in each of these weeks of history. For example, the first week, the only item characterized in the first week is the appearance of Enoch himself, who is the seventh man. But it goes through all of biblical history. Apparently, in the seventh week, the writer reaches his own time, that is, at the end of a jubilee period. He is living, and he believes that the end is coming soon, shortly after his own time. We, of course, regularly find in the apocalypses that the authors believe they are living at the most momentous time in history, and they understand everything in that way. Weeks 8 through 10 of that little apocalypse are descriptions of the judgment, taking up in reverse order the sinners of the first 3 weeks of world history. Those of the third week, that is, the sinful people after the flood, are judged in the eighth week. Those of the seventh week, the second week, that is, the sinful angels, are punished in week 9, and so on. It's a very artfully constructed little apocalypse, probably written just a little before Daniel, but also using this language of weeks, of sabbatical periods, all of which would culminate at the end of 70 of these, just as happens in Daniel chapter 9. Now, we know that both the book of Daniel and the Apocalypse of Weeks and some other apocalyptic works were made part of the library of the community that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. It is a community that has been described as an eschatological and apocalyptic community. They were living out this worldview of the apocalypses, were off in the wilderness, awaiting the fulfillment of God's promise to come into the wilderness where they were preparing his way, and there he would deliver them and punish their enemies. These prophecies or these predictions in the apocalyptic works were taken very seriously by this community, and they continued to comment upon them and develop them, even though they lived sometime after Daniel and the writer of the Apocalypse of Weeks. It was assumed that this was valuable material pointing toward the end. It just had to be interpreted properly. I want to close with a few comments about these texts and what the implications may be for us. For Jews and Christians today, the Apocalypse of Weeks has no authority. It doesn't occur in the scriptures, but Daniel does. First point, time designations play a role in the apocalypses, and presumably they were important for the authors. The time designations tend to be vague or heavily symbolic or both. In either event, they are open to different interpretations. If the writer of Daniel thought that an end was coming after 1150 days, 1290 days, or 1335 days, events did not turn out as expected, or the end was, as it were, anticlimactic. His numbers of days, seemingly so specific, must be related to his use of weeks of years as a symbolic chronological unit, and must be symbolic as well. We could add that the book of Revelation in the New Testament, while it devotes little space to such numbers, does have time indicators, and it is difficult to read the word soon in phrases such as what must soon take place, as intending a 1900-year period, and of course, there are different interpretations of that, as we have heard. Just as modern prognosticators of the time of the end have had a terrible record, the ancient ones also were not accurate. Daniel 9 shows us how such problems were handled. The writer knew that Jeremiah's prophecy of 70 years had not come true as he understood it. It therefore became necessary to seek another interpretation, namely the 70 years or 70 weeks of years. Second, while time indicators in the apocalypses have led to disappointment, it can be said that they are not the heart and soul of these apocalypses. We may characterize them as part of the literary baggage that distinguishes apocalypses, but specification of an exact time for the end, whatever the end meant for each author, seems not to have been the fundamental point of the texts. Such features add urgency to the message, but they do little more than articulate the widespread and very understandable notion that one's own time is the most momentous in history. There is a saying of Jesus that in the Synoptic Gospels is placed immediately after his longest apocalyptic speech. The Synoptic Apocalypse ends with Jesus predicting, "Truly I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place." Yet just two verses later, he is quoted as saying, "But about that day or hour, no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Beware, keep alert, for you do not know when the time will come," he says in Mark 13. His words may serve as a definitive commentary on any attempt to specify when the end will be. The Mishnah, the compilation of rabbinic law put into writing in about 200 AD, also contains this sort of warning. It says, "Whoever gives his mind to four things, it were better for him if he had not come into the world. What is above, what is beneath, what was before time, and what will be hereafter." Third, the message of the apocalypses is not in their numbers or in their graphic depictions of what will happen. All this tends to be highly traditional and symbolic. Their message lies in the assertion that there is a better, an eternal order, and that the present earthly order, with all its faults and pains, is only temporary. John Collins, at the end of his book, The Apocalyptic Imagination, says this: "The language of the apocalypses is not descriptive, referential, newspaper language, but the expressive language of poetry, which uses symbols and imagery to articulate a sense or feeling about the world. Their abiding value does not lie in the pseudo-information they provide about cosmology or future history, but in their affirmation of a transcendent world. Even if the physical universe were to endure forever, there is no doubt that the social and cultural worlds we inhabit are constantly crumbling. Christianity inherited from the Jewish apocalypses a way of affirming transcendent values, those things we should affirm even when the world around us collapses, or we perceive it to collapse. Beyond the thresholds of life and of this world, we can only see in a glass darkly, says Collins. The apocalyptic revelations are symbolic attempts to penetrate the darkness, which provide ways of imagining the unknown, not factual knowledge. The value of these imaginative ventures cannot be assessed by a correspondence theory of truth, he says, but only by evaluating the actions and attitudes which they supported. End of quote. The apocalypses affirm that there is a higher and more powerful authority who has final say over what happens on the earth. That affirmation is not dependent upon any dubious chronology in the apocalypses, however learned and expressive it may be. And finally, fourthly, in affirming God's knowledge of and control over everything, the apocalypses, arising from different situations, exhort the righteous to faithful endurance. At least in the Jewish apocalypses, one does not read a call to take up arms, but more of an emphasis on coping in hope through trials, knowing that God really does rule, and that at the appropriate time, he will make things right. The apocalyptists were able to present their comforting message, a message for all ages, through beautiful and at times powerful words. My favorite is the picture in Revelation 21, the beginning of John's vision of the new heaven and new earth, the new Jerusalem descending as a bride adorned for her husband. There John hears a loud voice from the throne saying, "The home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them as their God. They will be his peoples, and God himself will be with them. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away." And the one who was seated on the throne said, "I am making all things new." Also he said, "Write this, for these words are trustworthy and true." Then he said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end." The arrival of a new millennium, even one with computers, does not weaken the message of the apocalyptic writers who call upon the people of God to trust in him, in his power, and in his desire to save them. It is a message that we may gladly accept and eagerly proclaim to those who deal daily with the principalities and powers of this evil age. Thank you.